The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
Are we going to see the Fed walk the talk? Are we going to see the ECB step up and begin restricting and limiting liquidity? There are going to be consequences. And again, all the things that are overlooked in the short run now all of a sudden come into high relief because, oops, everything's permissible in a world of infinite liquidity and low rates. But you do have to mind your P's and Q's if the cost of capital is rising.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. We mentioned the smoke from the fire last week, Dave, but now we're on day 12 of a fire that's made national and international news. But what an incredible, almost militaristic military operation on fighting a fire. The coordination, the backburns, the over 800 people who are involved, the 15 to 20 major aircraft that are just continually working the lines. And they're not trying to put it out. They're actually directing the fire, hopefully the direction that they want, while saving. They haven't lost a single structure yet.
As a fascinating illustration of exponential growth, I mean, we were sitting here last week talking about a fire that was 2,500 to 3,000 acres, which is not a small fire by any means. And now it's over 23,000 acres.
A tenfold increase.
And you're right. It is interesting to watch professionals handle themselves with skill. And we've got the best. We've got the best in the country fighting the fire. And we're grateful for that.
Well, Dave, we've just passed an anniversary of one of the most influential military operations, maybe in world history. It changed at least the 20th century, the direction that the war was going. And I'm, of course, thinking of D-Day.
Yeah, I sat at the dinner table last week and my nine-year-old reminded me what day it was, and the day had nearly slipped by. There we are in the evening. 74 years ago was the D-Day invasion onto the beaches of Normandy.
The 70th anniversary, you guys went out actually to Normandy. You took the boys and Tess was with you too, right?
No, just the boys.
Okay, just the boys.
And it had slipped my mind last week, as I'm sure it might have for many, but 4 years ago, on the 70th anniversary, we visited the beach in Normandy and we walked the small towns which the U.S. Airborne liberated. And I think my boys will always remember that trip. They, because we do like to eat and fix various things as a family, they often mention the rabbit that we bought at a butcher shop, the entire thing. Big guy, bought at a butcher shop there in Saint-Mère-Église and turned it into a rabbit pie. And, but I hope they really remember the speech. We sat there at Pointe-à-Hoc and read a speech that Reagan had given on the 40th anniversary of D-Day. And it's so well done and it's so presidential. I wanted to include the link so that anybody who hasn't heard that speech, we took a written copy and I stood right there in front of the pillar and read it to the boys, and we were there with some friends and we all read it together.
It's important to remember, isn't it? I mean, memory is such an important part of developing a forward history.
And I think it's important to teach our children to remember too, because apparently sometimes we forget.
Yeah.
So I was just grateful. You know, the nine-year-old voice just asked me out of the blue, do you know what today is? And I'm like, I don't know what today is. He's like, well, this is the anniversary of D-Day. I'm like, oh.
Well, you know, I've even noticed as you go through the Bible, if you look at the word remember, it's almost always tied with obedience and prosperity. And when they would forget, if you look at the word forget all through the Bible, you see that it's almost always tied to disobedience and a loss of prosperity. But, you know, I'm going to shift to this week because we have had a free ride for the last decade, at least with interest rates. And that seems to be changing, not just here in the United States, but the European Central Bank is also talking about tightening.
Oh, this is a big week, not because we're going to see something different than expected, you know, from what the Fed has told us about, and or even different than what they've already done now six times here in recent years. But when tightening the flow of credit, when you do that via higher interest rates, there are thresholds that change things. And changing sentiment is a very delicate thing. mood tends to shift, and sometimes it's sort of based imperceptibly on small changes within the environment that you're in and the context that you're in. But as the mood shifts, so does the capital allocation process. And you've heard it in terms of sort of risk on and risk off.
Right.
Kind of the harsh, you know, bifurcated, I'm in the market or I'm out of the market. And those are kind of the facts that define bull markets and bear markets. But we may well be at one of those thresholds this week. On the table is the 7th increase in rates. And, you know, you don't have to look too far. Consider the real estate market just to illustrate the point. Mortgage rates have risen from a little over 3% to a hair under 5%. So if you're combining the high asking prices of real estate, given supply and demand dynamics, and higher financing costs, you're looking at affordability at this juncture, which is, you know, setting records, but, you know, not because it's affordable, because it's almost not affordable for anyone. So something has to give. At the same time, you've got the ECB, the European Central Bank, meeting on the 14th this week, and that may be just as vital. So this is a big week.
Well, what if we could go back, Dave, to 2008, 2009, right now, and know that the credit was going to be this easy for this long? I mean, really, only the imagination could limit what we could have done with all the free money that was coming. Now, that wasn't natural. This was a gift that was given from a future generation. My kids, your kids, this gift was given to us to say, all right, well, go ahead and just, we don't want the recession right now. We're going to go ahead and give you somebody else's money from tomorrow, today. Can you imagine if we would have known that?
Well, and I think if you consider what happened in that period, 2008, 2009, up to the present, you know, look at what happened inside the mind of the speculative community.
Right.
With the extension of quantitative easing, with mass monetization following the global financial crisis, all limits were removed from the imagination of the speculator.
But it happened gradually. What if they would have known from the get-go? I mean, really, in a way, we've enjoyed 10 years of prosperity that really wasn't ours.
And it's been building into a bonanza, but it wasn't a bonanza day one. I mean, back to 2008, 2009, you had equity returns trailing bond returns. You would have been better off sitting in treasury bills. And in fact, you were trailing treasury returns by about 14 years. If you were looking at just the performance of stocks beginning of the decade up through 2009,
T-bills would have been better.
Well, and you were down in real terms 50%, and that's giving back all of the dividends you would have earned along the way. So down 50%, plus you gave back all the income. It was an absolute disaster. But what happened was fascinating because, you know, the speculative community and that idea of imagination taking over, it gradually came into the awareness of the speculative community that prices can go to infinity or close to it if the cost of capital is zero. Now, we didn't get to zero overnight. So this was, again, part of the breaking in of this reality. It's like, well, what if rates are at 2%? Fine. Then we recalibrate everything. What if rates are at 1%? Oh, well, that's really interesting. What if rates are negative?
Right.
And now all of a sudden you're talking about sort of an infinite speculation.
And the speculators are going, you're kidding me, right? You're kidding me.
And this is a grand experiment with interest rates at the zero bound. And it revealed that excess speculation and increased enthusiasm, they only bump up against the glass ceiling of imagination. Basically, you can go as high as you want or as far as your imagination will take you.
Sure, because here's more money.
And when you're in that kind of a market environment, valuations and fundamentals, they recede from the market practitioner's concerns, at least for that period of time. So you've got the introduction of the limits of QE here in the United States.
Well, do you remember when they limited that back in 2014? At first, there was that
taper tantrum.
Yeah, oh my gosh. I remember we were watching on TV and it was like, no, 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 we're not going to accept that.
Right. So you've got the other side of the coin, really, with the limitations of QE, the beginnings of QT or quantitative tightening there at the end of 2014. You've got that fantasy of infinite valuations, infinite prices running into the brick wall of reality as tightening of credit was resuming, beginning to resume here in the United States just at the margins. And really, it's as liquidity was being limited. So the infinity equation was no longer realistic.
But the ECB took over the baton and the Bank of Japan.
Well, the Bank of Japan had been printing money and doing QE type stuff since 1999. So, I mean, they've been longest at it and they are to borrow from the Koreans if I can, they're the ones who are in really deep kimchi. I mean, the reality is the ECB and the Bank of Japan have allowed for a global speculative mood to continue in this interim period, 2014 to the present, because of the amount of money that they've been willing to put into the financial markets.
Well, and why is this important? You brought it out last week. Liquidity. You said perception and liquidity. Those two things.
And the ECB has indicated that their foray into that fantasy land is likely coming to a close. Bank of Japan, I mean, again, deep kimchi. I don't know how long they remain committed to sort of the open-ended, open-handed market interventions, but it may be forever until the system completely blows up on them. But liquidity is the key. Excess liquidity provides a boost to asset prices. That's a natural part of the equation. And if you start restricting or shrinking liquidity, that causes those same assets to shrink in value.
Do you think that the ECB is promising to also tighten up because of the potential drop of the euro?
Yeah, I think you've got the Fed tightening, right? They've been tightening since 2014. They're reducing what's on their balance sheet. Here in the next month or so, it'll be going at a $40 billion a month clip.
And that would strengthen the dollar if it looked like the ECB would continue to print.
Right. At the same time, you've got the ECB promising to do the same thing, tighten their monetary policy later this year, reduce balance sheet, et cetera, et cetera. And it does put the ECB between a rock and the hard place. Because on the one hand, if the ECB remains very accommodating, very dovish, as they say, then the euro is likely to take a hit. That adds even more fuel to a US dollar value going higher. And what does that cause? It causes immense damage to the emerging markets. Mm. Right? So that's one side of the equation, is if the ECB remains dovish.
I imagine the emerging markets, Dave, as you've been talking about them over the last couple of months, as if you ever watch the skaters like at the Ice Follies, where you've got the people in the center who are doing the circles, then you've got the people who join a little further and join, and the skaters on the very outside are having to run as fast as they possibly can to join the line, and they're the first ones thrown off. You know what I'm talking about? That spinning line. The emerging markets right now are so vulnerable to what's occurring in the center of that ice skating line. They're running as fast as they possibly can. And frankly, they're not keeping up.
I grew up at an ice rink and I have no idea what you're talking about. You know, but what I did see, you know, because I played hockey all growing up.
Okay.
And my sister was a figure skater. And, you know, when people would practice, you'd have the folks that couldn't skate at all holding onto the edges at the periphery.
Right.
And then the folks who were doing like the triple axels or double lutzes, or for me, it would have been a triple klutz or whatever. I didn't ice skate.
Actually, you became a pretty good skater, didn't you?
You were
a goalie.
I can skate backwards very well.
Okay.
But that was, you know, the domain of the central. You had the power skaters in the middle,
right.
And then at the periphery, it was everyone who was barely hanging on. And literally, they were actually just hanging on to the edge for even balance.
So what occurs in Europe, what occurs in the United States, and I'll even count Japan, directly affects these emerging markets to the point where it's a survival situation.
Well, and I think going back to that contrast, so we've got the potential for the ECB remaining accommodating. But on the other hand, if they get more hawkish, if they do restrict liquidity into the system, number one, it stabilizes the euro, right? That may be good for the euro. That also caps the upside in the dollar. And to a large degree, it extends a lifeline to the emerging markets in so doing. Probably if you do that, if you're tightening liquidity, even though it's good for the euro and caps the upside on the dollar and is good for the emerging markets in terms of stopping the bleeding, you do stir financing issues for your over-leveraged banks. Mm. And I think this is one of the things that the ECB is very concerned about. Do they care about the emerging markets? Yeah, to some degree. Why should they? Well, I mean, I guess the question is, do they care more about the banking sector? Because, I mean, if you look at globalization, if you look at the emerging markets, the strength of globalization is also its weakness.
Right. So interconnectedness is a big deal. I mean, if the butterfly flaps its wings here, it's the hurricane in China.
That's right. So you've got all these things which tie us together, our surpluses or someone else's deficits, and they match and mirror globally. what happens in Brazil, what happens in Argentina, what's happening in Turkey, all of these things right now, they send ripple effects into the global system of liquidity and risk taking. Mm-hmm. And they signal either a positive backdrop for speculation or they signal a negative backdrop for speculation. And those are self-reinforcing tendencies. So yes, the ECB does care about what happens in the emerging markets because of the way it affects the whole mood of the markets globally. Again, the question is, what do they care more about?
Okay, and you talked about signaling a negative backdrop, but actually the signal's been messed with for the last few years. You've got high-frequency trading that has almost completely eliminated volatility in the market. You've got the mainline media, okay, the news media, that continually talks up whatever market they need to talk up. So are we going to have that confused, distorted, or actually just completely white-noised out signal where we can't actually see what's going on, or are there tipping points that the perception media and the HFTs, the high-frequency traders, can't smooth out?
Well, I was fascinated reading Bert Doman's most recent letter, the Wellington letter, because he's having a hard time calling the market on the basis of technicals. And of course, technical analysis is really his claim to fame. Of course, he brings in some good fundamental overlays, but technical analysis is how he created a reputation for making market calls.
Which requires a signal. You have to have clear signal.
And he's hesitating to call the market on the basis of technicals due to algorithms dominating and defining trends in ways that make the charts to some degree irrelevant. So in many respects, this is why if you're talking about the algorithms, the high-frequency traders, which at this point are 80 to 90% of volume on the New York Stock Exchange, up from a 70% average a few years ago, they complement the media news cycle in a way that's really, it is muting market signals, and it is reinforcing the current trend in place. I don't know that it can necessarily redefine a trend, but it certainly is reinforcing the existing trend. But there are places where beyond the media news cycle, the high frequency trading, the algorithms, which kind of, again, sort of mute the market signaling, you are getting something loud and clear. Exchange rates and interest rates, and they are carrying a signal loud and clear.
Well, and does that then force what you were talking about, prioritizing? Do you prioritize emerging markets or do you prioritize banks? We've seen banks in the past stick with banks. In other words, they're going to bail the banks out first. They did this during the financial crisis. The guys who made the worst mistakes are still around because they were too big to fail. So I would imagine that you're probably, if push comes to shove, they're going to pick themselves before they pick the emerging market.
Right. So you're back to seeing the spreads widen between your risk-free rates, whether that's the U.S. 10-year treasury or the German Bund, and things like the Portuguese, Italian, and Spanish debt. Spreads are widening, yields rising at the European periphery, and it's cracks in the current structure of finance which are appearing. So back to the European banking community, they certainly do not relish the idea of tighter liquidity or higher rates. Why? Because they're over-leveraged as they are.
Mm-hmm. Why pay more interest for the leverage that they've got?
When their balance sheet just doesn't allow for it. This is, again, the revelation of priorities. As you said a minute ago, banks care for banks. Mm-hmm. And here in the middle of this, we've got Deutsche Bank. You know, we talked about donuts and whatever last week, but Deutsche Bank's the worst offender by far in terms of leverage and derivative exposure, and it's getting special attention from Merkel week after week. So is the European Central Bank now on the horns of a dilemma where they have to choose between global financial market accommodation and support of the emerging markets, or the European banking system accommodation? And my guess, for what it's worth, is that central banks are going to choose the banks. Ergo, emerging markets are in a very vulnerable position because it's almost like, yeah, but those are long-term knock-on effects as opposed to markets being able to seize and liquidity seizing up overnight if you don't take care of the financial institutions in the heartland. So to me, if there's anyone who's sort of the, you know, proverbial goat to be slaughtered here, it's probably the emerging markets in favor of the European banks.
Well, and just look at who's having to be bailed out at this point. The IMF, the largest bailout, I think, in the history of the IMF just occurred in Argentina.
This is last week. You're right. So stress is emerging. in the emerging markets, Argentina is one on the list, and the IMF bailout comes in at $50 billion. That's last week. It's the largest IMF bailout in history. There's been other bailouts that have been larger, but from the IMF, it exceeded anything anyone had imagined.
Well, you'd never know it looking at the markets. I mean, the markets didn't care. They just yawned.
Well, particularly underwhelmed if you're looking at the peso-dollar exchange rate, because it continued to rapidly decline even after the announcement of that $50 billion intervention to a 25-to-1 rate to the U.S. dollar.
Well, let me ask, is this going to be enough? I mean, is a $50 billion infusion into the Argentinian situation enough?
With every version of fixing the system using debt, it's iteration after iteration after iteration. So it may be enough in terms of a quantity, but the terms that they put on it will probably have to be adjusted. But if you go back to the last IMF bailout cycle in Argentina, so this is, you know, 17 years ago, 2000 to 2001, just back up and think of this. You've got too much debt, which was the cause of the crisis. And what's the IMF doing then that it's doing now that all of our central banks tend to do? Debt was the cause of the crisis, to which more debt and restrictive expectations for those bailout funds are then applied, mm-hmm. which led to total collapse, right? So the IMF bails out Argentina and they can't live under the new pressure of the total stock of debt, and it causes a total collapse there in 2000-2001, $132 billion in foreign defaults. Elliott Management tried to step in and buy a lot of that paper at a steep discount and try to make a fortune that way. And, you know, they've been tied up in court for decades. But on this round, we have the accumulation of $100 billion US. This is Argentine debt, but the equivalent of $100 billion in US dollars over the last 2.5 years. Slap on a $50 billion 3-year deal, as if 36 months is enough to kind of cure the issues, which are deeply politically entrenched. And I think you at best look at this and say, okay, it's the first round, it's the first iteration. Eventually, that 36 months may be 36 years, because the reality is they haven't fixed the engine of growth sufficient to keep up with the old debt, let alone the new $50 billion in obligations.
So we've talked about the Reinhardt and Rogoff book about bond defaults all through history, 600, 700 years, over and over and over. We started this program talking about the importance of remembering and not forgetting. But it seems like, as far as the debt markets go, they've got a very short memory.
Well, you know, I read the Rogoff book, this time it's different, on the plane ride to Argentina,
right,
back in 2008, is the book had just come out. And I'm reminded of John Kenneth Galbraith famously saying that financial disaster is quickly forgotten. There can be few fields of human endeavor in which history counts for so little as in the world of finance.
Mm.
And again, it's the permanence of greed, the shortness of memory, those things put together in a strange cocktail in the financial markets are very, 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 very forgiving. And one of the things that Rogoff and Reinhardt point out in their book is that, contrary to what you might have thought, you know, the Argentines in their earlier collapses, again, going back 70, 80, 90 years, they were the good citizens who tried to pay back their debt, as if good standing in the financial markets mattered. But you had Ecuador, Honduras, a bunch of other countries that also capitulated and made no attempt to pay it back. And their economies recovered very quickly. Why? Because they were back to the capital markets and borrowing within about a 7-year period. And it was like all is forgotten, literally, because Wall Street didn't have the memory for it. And so Argentina suffered under honorably paying back the debt over decades, and no one ever forgot that, because they actually were trying to live true to the terms that had been set, versus just, hey, sort it out. You're screwed. You can't have your money back. We default.
Well, that's the definition of moral hazard, isn't it? Where, you know, the person can take as much risk as they want and really not have to pay for it. But we're talking about remembering something. You would think that these countries would remember not to borrow in someone else's currency. That's usually what crushes them.
That's right. So much of the debt issued since the global financial crisis, and this is what is amazing, because this is a short-term blunder, but it's also a classic blunder. It's what economists call the original sin, which is not the same thing as what theologians would define as the original sin. But this is when you choose to denominate debt in a foreign currency, not your domestic one. And the vast majority of debt restructurings have occurred because of this blunder. And it still persists. Again, most of the debt in the emerging markets, which has been issued since the global financial crisis, has been in US dollar or euro terms, foreign currency terms, which makes it that much harder to pay back in the context of currency devaluation. So emerging markets remain at risk. You get the Mexican peso, which is still under massive pressure. The Turkish lira is also under pressure with a massive amount of foreign denominated debt. That was a conversation we've had ongoing with Russell Napier. The Brazilian real remains under pressure. The Brazilian stock market is down 14, almost 14.5% in 1 month. In 1 month. So when the air starts to come out of the balloons of the emerging markets, it comes up very, very quickly. And again, you may ask, why does that matter to me? I don't have vacation plans and my portfolio exposure isn't to any of those places. Welcome to a world that has reaped the benefits of globalization. And it also lives with the drawbacks. Again, we come back to that issue of interconnectedness. There are no country-specific firewalls that sort of contain concern or barricade off that risk-off behavior. When people start to sell, again, you may have a problem in Taiwan that all of a sudden is now a problem in South Korea. We're not talking political, although right. that could emerge. We're talking about market transmission, which, again, doesn't know boundaries or borders. In an age of globalization, I mean, you could even think of it in terms of some of the movies that in the late 90s, early 2000s, like Outbreak, where they talk about whether it's Ebola or some other kind of virus. How much more quickly can disease travel in the age of jet transportation?
Right.
I mean, it's a totally different world. Go back to the 1340s when we had the Black Plague in Europe. You know, 24 million people in and around the Mediterranean die of this disease. And if you look at where everyone was dying, it was all along the trade routes, right? Because it had to deal with transmission and you had to have people carrying it. You had to be carrying stuff which carried the rats, which carried the fleas, which carried the disease. But it was transmission. Today, we don't have a slow transmission mechanism in a globalized financial environment.
It's instantaneous. And Dave, you're a mountain climber, and I'm trying to remember, I think it was Mount Hood where we read in Gonzalez's book, Deep Survival. Remember that story of the five climbers that were tied in with each other? You had five climbers and you have the security, I'll call it like globalization. You have the benefit of being tied into five climbers, but you also have the vulnerability if one or two of those climbers goes, it pulls the other three down. And that happened and they lost five climbers. Was it Hood or what's the mountain that you and Gabe were climbing?
Mount Rainier.
It was either Rainier or Hood that happened.
Remember from the story.
But it was the same thing. They had the security of the tie-in. In fact, they took more risk because they had the security of the tie-in. But the very tie-in itself is what ended up pulling them all off the mountain.
Aggregate the weight, and no one of them can withstand that much of a burden.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, so stress in one geography, it's transmitted quickly to other geographies. I think that's really the issue. And so it's helpful in the short run that central bank interventions can step in and, you know, calm the storm, get people off the emotional boil, and extend whatever trend is in place. In the end, it ends up being harmful. Mm-hmm. It's harmful because it takes prices to an even less sustainable level, a higher height from which to fall.
Okay. But we have, quote, the experts, the academics, and, you know, the calm, grandfatherly voice of either the Alan Greenspans or the Janet Yellens, and they have a tendency to come in and say, you know what, there's absolutely nothing to worry about. The thing that worries me is after looking at this for, you know, three decades, when they come out and tell you that there's nothing to worry about, that's usually days before there is.
Fascinating to me to think of Alan Greenspan, a guy who was at the helm for a couple of decades.
Right.
No one understood what he said. Even the PhDs in economics didn't understand what he said because he spoke Greenspeak.
But he could calm you down with Greenspeak.
But Greenspeak was a way. That's right. Because yeah. You just said that sounded so complex and he understands what he's saying. I should just trust the guy.
Right.
So it was this defer to authority as a result of confusion and chaos, and it was 100% intentional. And we've actually lost something in the midst of using clarified and clear language from the Fed. Now we're like, oh, Ooh. Well, they're going to raise rates. Or, before you would have been like, I don't know if he's promising his firstborn son or if he's going to lower rates or if he's just going to feed the dog at lunchtime. I mean, you had no idea what he was talking about. But in 73, I mean, this is one of those, I think of all the experts, Greenspan, Bernanke, the guys and gals who've run the Fed, none of them saw a crisis coming. And it's fascinating because you have the higher market prices at present here in the U.S. And if you think about the prophetic voices of those past central bank presidents, Greenspan in 73, January of 1973, said, it's very rare that you can unqualifiedly be bullish as you can be now. Of course, we went into a massive recession in 74. Mm-hmm. The stock market had started to go limp in 68, but we were in a full-blown economic recession in 74. And as far as he was concerned, standing on the high hill where he was standing, looking out on the horizon, all he could see is that you should be unqualifiedly bullish. And what he missed was what was going to happen next.
Well, and, you know, the tech stock bubble, we keep bringing it up because it was such a profound thing. But I remember the Super Bowl of January, early February of 2000, the commercials. I can't remember if it was the last week in January or the first week in February, but the commercials were ridiculous because these were dot-com companies that had no profits whatsoever. Their combined capitalization because of the stocks just going through the roof was greater than all the airlines out there and, you know, anything that actually did anything. And at that same time, Greenspan came out with a prediction. Yeah, January of 2000,
right.
He wanted to let everybody know that things were fine.
It's the same tone from his lips. There can be little argument that the American economy, as it stands at the beginning of the new century, has never exhibited so remarkable a prosperity for at least the majority of Americans. And again, I mean, you're talking about on the edge of the next major decline, the next major recession.
45 days after that, the NASDAQ just almost disappeared.
Down by 85 to 90%.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a big deal. Janet Yellen in 2007, I mean, again, you fast forward and you think, well, maybe they learned something through time. And in January of 2007, she said, while the decline in housing activity has been significant and will probably continue for a while longer, I think the concerns we used to hear about the possibility of a devastating collapse, one that might be big enough to cause a recession in the U.S. economy, have been largely allayed.
Yeah. And within the next year, we had the GFC, the global financial crisis.
Right. So I guess when you look at things today, economy's humming along, prices in the stock market are just fine. Prices change quickly when sentiment shifts. Mm. And sentiment shifts when liquidity dynamics change. I mean, we could point to a number of things at this point. We could point to the deterioration in the quality of corporate bonds. We could harp on the quantity of covenant-lite loans in the marketplace, which far exceed what we had in 2006 prior to the global financial crisis, 6 and 7. We could talk about the buyback schemes and the earnings games that are being played by corporations, insider selling versus insider buying. And certainly, we could, and we've discussed sort of the overvalued nature of the market. If you're looking at Tobin's Q or, you know, the Buffett indicator, which again, we're at about 140% versus 150% being the all-time high. That is the stock market capitalization compared to the total size and scale of the economy. But all of these issues, all these issues are minimized. All these issues are overlooked until a threshold is reached.
Yes, but can they not continue to supply unlimited liquidity? I mean, do we ever reach a threshold if they continue to supply unlimited liquidity?
That's the experiment with the Bank of Japan. And to a degree, we talked about that last week. This is what would be required, transforming the financial system that we know today to a closed system, one where they can control the inputs and outputs, the flows in and out, and require you to participate, a forced participant in the marketplace. You know, so on that basis, you could. The Bank of Japan is experimenting with it. Scandinavians have experimented with it. They're beginning to experiment with that kind of a system in India. But I think when you're talking about thresholds, you're talking about something that's non-mathematical, non-numeric. And the threshold ties to sentiment. There is confidence in this mix. And sentiment is driven or it's buttressed by liquidity. So I think of it as a liquidity threshold because of what is actually supporting it. But when that liquidity begins to shift, When that flips, so does the perception of everything else. So again, you know, today nobody's caring about the quality of corporate bonds. Nobody's caring about covenant light loans. Nobody's caring about buyback schemes. Nobody's caring about the earnings games that are being played. Nobody's caring about corporate malfeasance, frankly, and theft. But people begin to care when liquidity shifts and there's not enough of it anymore. So take the German factory orders as an example. This last month, they unexpectedly dropped for a fourth month in a row, German factory orders. That signifies that the German economy is slipping. Okay? It's germane. Not German. It's germane. But it doesn't matter until the ECB starts signaling tightening. And if the ECB starts to signal that they're tightening their liquidity measures in the economy, in the market, then there is a whole litany of concerns which are going to surface, including the factory order numbers, which are going to be interpreted in a fresh light.
Well, and you can have an awful lot of foolish investments that people ignore and actually put money into. Foolishness, like I remember, again, the dot-com bubble, the sock puppet, okay, the pets.com sock puppet. Pets.com was a larger business than, like I had mentioned before, all the airlines in America. It had more capitalization than all the airlines in America. Now, it just completely vaporized when things came down. Now, what we have, you know, we've got Toys R Us bonds. We've got stuff out there that people will go, oh, well, you know, as long as they're bailing these things out, I'll go ahead and take some of those.
Well, it was chasing yield. And Bloomberg asked the question on the 4th of June in an article on their site. They asked the question, what did Toys R Us bonds, the populist threat in the European Union, and Turkish external debt have in common? All are tolerated by market players until quite suddenly they weren't.
And they turned out to be sock puppets.
The article went on to say the binary all-in, all-out behavior, which up until now was relegated to the fringes of the financial markets, has gone mainstream. And then they reference the Italian markets, and the article says investors are becoming increasingly manic. Mm. And to us, it's a question of sort of the internals of the market and the feeling and the sentiment which is in the collective market participants. It's shifting. It hasn't capitulated, but it's getting to the point where panic would be quite easy.
Now, I'm going to talk a little bit of conspiracy here, but let's say that you are the ECB and you have the ability to print. We talked to Ottmar Issing, and Ottmar Issing, of course, you talk to him, he was the founder of the European Central Bank. He was the head of the European Central Bank for 7 years. One of the things he admitted to you, Dave, was that the weakness of the European Monetary Union was that it was only a monetary union. It was not a political union. In other words, you don't have control over the leadership. And you've got an Italy out there, or you've got a Spain. You've got these countries who may exercise some form of independence. Now, do you think, and this is where the conspiracy comes in a little bit, do you think they sort of like having some of these countries a little bit on the defensive, knowing that their only survival is the mothership?
I think it's reasonable to recognize that politics is a blood sport. And just like Wyoming reintroducing bare knuckle fighting, it's now legal. It's been illegal for years.
Really?
Yeah, but I mean, this is common in terms of the way things are done in the world of politics. Hmm. Gloves are off, teeth are knocked out. And it is not the realm for gentlemen. And not the way politics actually is. You may have some sanitized version of it, but even the way we behave in the United States, where we have both sides of the aisle and everyone defers their time to the speaker, et cetera, et cetera. You look at the way the parliament in England works, and these guys know how to hold a teacup and smoke a pipe and do everything in the finery and go shopping at the haberdasheries and whatever else. But you put them in parliament, and they start cussing each other out, and they're like, shut the pup, 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 pup. I mean, you can't get
true.
A word in edgewise. The reality is, behind the scenes, that's the way politics works. It's mean and nasty and disrespectful.
So the ECB is a political organization.
Oh, absolutely. It's a political organization. And we mentioned this earlier this week on an interview I did on Steel on Steel with our friend John Loeffler. The ECB restricted their purchases of Italian debt last month, more so than any other month since the 2015 program began, when they were buying government bonds, when that whole thing got started. What does it feel like to be in a political and financial or fiscal crisis without the full support of the ECB? Hmm. I think the ECB was sending a very clear message. It's like, all right, you've got some cracks in your system.
How does this feel?
You're going to elect a populist. Do you know what happens when your markets blow up? We're just going to give you a little taste of that. We're stepping back from the markets so you can feel the heat. the ECB wanted the Italians to feel the heat so as to not do something stupid, which in the opinion of the ECB was move away from the euro and move towards an utterly populist regime.
Well, and I know we're looking towards the Fed meeting this week, but also the ECB meets this week as well. I mean, they'll transform that into interest rate politics too, won't they?
June 14th meeting of the ECB in Latvia, just like the Fed meeting over the next 2 days, it may signal precisely what the market cannot handle, which is present tense limits to the liquidity game.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, honestly, what do we know? Nothing. Can they do this? Do they have what it takes to normalize interest rates? To this point, the Fed and the ECB have talked the talk, but there are consequences to rising rates. And that's what we're talking about is you get to a threshold moment and it recalculates, it recalibrates everything. People look at every fact and figure differently in light of how they feel. And those feelings and sentiments are determined by liquidity flows.
So no matter what they say, they are still buying billions and billions of bonds.
Well, I mean, and that's what we have sort of juxtaposed. On the one hand, we've got the ECB balance sheet growing another $5 billion this week to an all-time high of 4.567 trillion euros, and the market's calm about that. No big deal. Reversal of that trend would have consequences, right? And they've talked about it. They've talked about reversing that trend. And if they do, there will be consequences.
Okay, but Richard Duncan is saying, hey, maybe that Japanese model will work. Maybe this will work in the long run for everybody.
And I don't know that he's a champion of the model. He's just saying that in a system that's driven by liquidity, if liquidity is tightening everywhere but the Bank of Japan, perhaps the Bank of Japan is providing sufficient liquidity to float all boats. And I don't know. But I mean, there is the suggestion that extreme quantitative easing undertaken by the Bank of Japan may be sufficient to keep the global asset markets afloat a little bit longer. And that's better than them falling to pieces, in Duncan's opinion. But I don't know. I mean, it's liquidity, liquidity, liquidity.
Right.
That has been the theme, I think, for us for a couple of months. And, you know, as we get closer to some of these dates where are we going to see the Fed walk the talk? Are we going to see the ECB step up and begin restricting and limiting liquidity? There are going to be consequences. And again, all the things that are overlooked in the short run now all of a sudden come into high relief because, oops, everything's permissible in a world of infinite liquidity and low rates. But you do have to mind your P's and Q's if the cost of capital is rising.
You know, it would be a good time for us to have, you know, you mentioned bare knuckle fighting. And when I think of Bill King and his analysis, because this is a guy who's had to survive. I mean, this is a guy who trades and he's held accountable when he's wrong. He's praised when he's right. You know, he's a bare knuckle fighter, an analyst of this. And it makes sense to maybe have him on in the next week or two to talk about these issues.
That's a great idea. I'd love to press him for his thoughts on the markets. Of course, he's always got thoughts on politics and geopolitics. And
he doesn't hold back.
Now, you know, in a recent note, he said summer rallies on low volume, summer rallies in the stock market, when you have low volume and extremely bullish trader sentiment with concentrated buying in just a few of the trading sardines, short-term gains, no doubt, but it gets you set up for an autumn full of pain. Mm. That's the way the market is setting up. That's from a recent comment of his. You've got bank stocks, which are beginning to break down. And he had a comment on that as well. Stock market rally can't last much longer if banks take a tumble in the coming days or weeks.
Well, you brought up musical chairs. Okay. The music is still going. I mean, I'll grant you that. The music has not stopped. We're still going around in circles around those chairs. But there's signs that the music's going to stop. And I think King is basically saying this fall could even be possibly when that happens.
Right. What's fascinating is you're seeing a growing consensus of, and granted, it's the bears at each of the firms, whether it's at Societe Generale or JP Morgan or even Goldman Sachs, they may not call for chaos in the fall of 2018, but they can't make the numbers work as you get into 2019 and 2020. So for them, you know, we're in a 24 to 36 month time frame, anywhere from the next 2 weeks to the next 2.5 years, where we see more pain than the market can really bear. I was reading John Hussman the other day, and he says, yeah, look, to see a 66% decline, a 2/3 decline in the S&P from these levels, that is what we expect in the completion of this cycle. And, you know, Huspin's no dummy. He is no dummy. Definitely a credit analyst, as is our Doug Noland. And for him, I think gathering chairs would be getting into treasury bonds. For us, gathering chairs is probably getting into ounces, but fewer chairs are available each week. The music is playing. You're right. People are happy with that. But as we suggested last week, keep your eye on the chairs.
Well, I definitely want a chair when the music stops. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. And you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.